Okay, folks, welcome to the second installment of this short course, second of five, on numerical modeling. I guess first off, just we'll start off this class the way we finished off last class. Any questions on last class? We'll save those up to a later time. In terms of today, I mean, it's for sure it's all to do with numerical modeling, but today I'm not going to cover really anything to do with numerical modeling. It's just going through the big pile of rules and regulations that electromagnetic fields obey and satisfy. There's a whole big redundant set of rules and laws. But when it comes to doing numerical modeling, it ends up being that, sure, the true electromagnetic fields satisfy all these laws, Maxwell's laws and everything else, conservation of charge, all the continuity of the tangential electric field across an interface, so all these kind of rules and regulations. However, when it comes to numerical modeling, we're going to be working with approximate fields, and just because you're working with approximate fields, there's no way, there's no hope that those electric fields are going to satisfy all the rules and regulations that these true fields satisfy. So in some respects, the sort of the trick with the numerical modeling of electromagnetic fields, especially in the context that we're interested in, so electromagnetic fields in the ground and the earth, the trick is making sure that the particular rules and regulations that get violated by our approximate fields are not the most important rules and regulations governing the particular physical behavior down in the ground, or if we're modeling things up in the air in that context. So that's kind of why I want to just take today's class, go through these whole set of rules and regulations, completely redundant. We get boundary conditions from Maxwell's equations, but I just want to look at this whole sort of sequence of rules and regulations, just because when it comes to doing numerical modeling, it's good to have this whole pile, this whole set of regulations in the back of my mind to just try and keep track of which are being satisfied and which perhaps are being violated. So that's for today's class. So just starting off with arguably the most important ones, Maxwell's equations, and starting off with Faraday's law of electromagnetic induction, in terms of differential form, you know, the partial derivatives, the electric field, so how the electric field is varying with position, you know, it's related to the time rate of change of the magnetic field. Differential form, this is valid for a particular point in space, valid at every point in space. It's okay. Equivalently, the integral form, where we've now got the integral around some closed curve of the tangential component of that electric field, and related to that, the time rate of change of the total flux of the magnetic field through that surface. So an integral form which is explicitly thinking of a particular curve and the surface that's bounded by that curve, whereas differential form very much thinking about a point in space. In the terms of just a sort of sentence, a throwaway sentence, then time-varying magnetic field will generate a sort of curly electric field. This is essentially sort of a bit more particular qualitative statement, comes out of Grant and West, the book by Grant and West, and just a little diagram. So if you have your magnetic field lines and the magnetic field is varying as a function of time, then associated with that magnetic field, we're going to get our electric field that's induced, and it tends to wrap itself around the magnetic field. So that just relationship embodied in Faraday's law between time-varying magnetic field and the induced electric field. Just one or two other points. If we go for e to the minus I omega t time dependence, and every time I introduce a time dependence through this course, I think I've tried to be consistent and go with this convention, then of course we get our I omega b. Just to sort of state the obvious, but doesn't do any harm to state the obvious. Faraday's law only comes into effect if we have our time-varying magnetic fields. It's good to keep that in mind. This exists everywhere, so if we've got our time-varying magnetic field, then that's going to give us our induced electric field everywhere. We're only going to get induced currents if we then sit inside a conductor, but a little bit more on that at the moment, because then we have to think of Ohm's law before we can deal with that. But our time-varying magnetic field gives us our electric field. Yesterday's class, essentially the governing equation that I based everything on was the partial differential equation, the usual standard way of coming up with a governing equation for the physics that's going on. It's not the only way of doing it. But if you go in with differential equations, then it's going to be this form, the differential form of Faraday's law that you're working with. When it comes to thinking about deriving a numerical solution, especially in multi-dimensions, the differential form might not necessarily be the best way to go about it. Actually, going back to the integral form, where you're explicitly thinking of some closed loop and the surface bounded by that loop, that might actually be a better way to start thinking about deriving a numerical solution. A little bit more on that later, not in today's class. Okay, so that's Faraday's law, kind of law number one, arguably. Ampere's law, as written sort of as one of other of Maxwell's equations. So curl, H, not B. And here, not doing quasi-static yet, I'll get to that in a moment. So including the displacement current density as well as the current density of free charges. So if we have our moving charge as a current, then associated with that, there's going to be a magnetic field. So this is relating the partial derivatives in space of the H field with the flow of charge, no time derivative on the right-hand side of the current density, which is important. Again, differential form is also the equivalent integral form. We're explicitly thinking of a curve, a closed loop, and the total tangential component of the H field around that loop, and how that's related to the total flow of charge through the surface bounded by that loop. You know, so two equivalent statements, one thinking at a particular point about point in space, the other thinking of an explicit closed curve. Excuse me, and then sort of a throwaway kind of phrase that if you have an electric current, you know, not necessarily time varying, just a simple electric current, then it will generate or tend to have associated with it some curly magnetic field. Again, the slightly more specific statement coming out of Grant and West's book and the sort of typical sketch diagram showing if we have our current flowing, then associated with it, there's going to be a magnetic field that tends to wrap itself around the current. So just going through the basics here. A few more comments about Ampere's law. I'll talk about the quasi-static situation in a moment. That gets rid of the displacement current density to just give us the relationship between flow of free charge and the curl of the H field. Excuse me. The way these things stand at the moment, Faraday's law and Ampere's law, the way I presented them, they're starting to look as if they're all so symmetrical or close to being symmetrical, but no, because it's for Faraday's law, it was curl E and the time derivative of B, whereas we've got an H here and we've got a J, as well as the D by DT. So, you know, there's a bit of a pattern there, a symmetrical kind of pattern between the two, but it's not really symmetric. There's very important differences, notably the D by DT in Faraday's law, and the fact that it's J and in Ampere's law and the electric field in Faraday's law. A little bit more about this in a moment. And just as for Faraday's law and thinking about setting up a numerical scheme, maybe the differential form is a good way to think about it, but perhaps the integral form is actually a better way to think about starting to set up a numerical scheme. Okay, so those are sort of the two, arguably the highest level, the main, most important laws. As for all sorts of others, the constitutive relationships are how the properties of materials get into Maxwell's equations. And there's a relationship between magnetic induction and magnetic field strength, although I can never really remember the proper names, B field and H field, related by magnetic permeability. And so if you have materials with weird and wonderful magnetic properties, then the effects of those properties have to get into Maxwell's equations through that thing, that entity, whether it's a number or whether it's something more complicated. Excuse me. Likewise, relationship between displacement and electric field with this nice little permittivity sitting there. In terms of most of electromagnetic geophysics, definitely not all, but in terms of sort of most of electromagnetic geophysics, we're going to get by with thinking of these as just nice simple constants. There are certain electromagnetic prospecting systems, certainly loop-loop frequency domain airborne systems that can actually pick up the effects of magnetic susceptibility. in these EM measurements, but those effects are definitely secondary to the effects that are coming from your conductivity in the ground. So yeah, some EM methods are sensitive to this, but at a sort of secondary level. There's one very particular method in geophysics, the induced polarization method, which is totally going after the polarization, so essentially the properties or the effects of that particular constant. It does involve time-varying fields, but it's very slowly varying, very particular kind, so it's very close to the DC resistivity method. So it's very important mineral exploration, a niche market, so to speak. But as far as all other EM methods are concerned, then usually we can get by with saying epsilon is just equal to epsilon naught. I mean, I think there have been some claims of perhaps seeing polarization effects in MT data, but I'm not at all sure about that. So basically, for most of EM geophysics, we can get by thinking permeability of free space, permittivity of free space in our constitutive relations. And so that means the only sort of constitutive relation, it's more important than that, but the only constitutive relation of any consequence is Ohm's law. So again, it's the same form relationship between two particular fields with a material property that gets in there relating the two, current density and electric field. But this now is the electrical conductivity of our material, in our case, electrical conductivity of the earth, of the subsurface. And because we're dealing with the subsurface, this is very important for electrical engineers looking at electromagnetic fields propagating through the air. This is of no consequence to them, whereas for us, this is the biggest deal there is. So this is how the earth is going to get into Maxwell's equations, as far as we're concerned. In terms of the, there is a symmetry between Ampere's law and Faraday's law, but you really need Ampere's law to complete it. This was Faraday's law and Ampere's law, as they initially appeared a few slides back. Faraday's law, electric field in there, magnetic field. Ampere's law, it's a current density in the magnetic field. With the constitutive relations in Ohm's law, I mean, sure, we can say B and H are just the same except for a constant. So we get H in here. The important aspect really is that we can, if we're sitting in a conductor, so if we're sitting in the earth, then we can relate our electric conductivity to the electric field that's driving that current. So now we've got our Faraday's law and our Ampere's law, both in terms of E and H. So now we've got this coupled system essentially, because we're sitting in a conductor, because any induced electric fields that we now have because of a time-varying magnetic field, because we're sitting in a conductor, they can force charges to move. That gives us our current, and hey presto, as soon as we've got a current, that gives us back our H field. So that gives this coupling between Faraday's law and Ampere's law. Just sort of a diagram again, classic diagram to sort of illustrate this. This is very much thinking of, say, EM prospecting system that has a small transmitter loop, say a meter in diameter, like some of the classic airborne systems. So this is a little transmitter loop. If you have your current flowing in there, it will generate a magnetic field that has a spatial variation, kind of like these darker blue lines somewhat. So very magnetic dipolar in shape to the field lines. In terms of this, the green lines here, they kind of represent a very crude Earth model where we've got, say, a homogeneous half space that could be perfectly resistive. But we do have this conductive lump there, idealized conductive lump in which the conductivity is non-zero. So here we have our primary magnetic field. If it is varying with time, then Faraday's law tells us that, hey, we're going to get an electric field induced. It's going to be induced everywhere in this diagram. So we've got our induced electric field. If we then consider our conductive lump, then we've got our non-zero electrical conductivity. Ohm's law comes into effect. Those induced electric fields will then force our current to move. So yes, we will get current flowing, induced currents flowing. They're completely constrained within this conductive region because in this diagram, this outer half space is essentially resistive. So we've got our induced currents from Ohm's law. And now, hey, we've got Ampere's law. So okay, we've got these currents. So they themselves are giving rise to their own secondary magnetic field, these lighter blue lines. The shape and size and strength of that secondary field depends on the shape and size and strength of the currents induced in our conductor. which in turn depend on shape and size and conductivity of our conductive lump. So this would be our secondary magnetic field that we can come along and measure, hopefully, with our system. And so this is the whole process of electromagnetic induction. It's the linkage via the magnetic field between our source and this conductive lump that's causing things to happen. So completely sort of Faraday's law of EM induction. I mean, there's no current flowing in here at all, so there's no current flowing between source and conductive object. This is going to be in contrast to sort of the galvanic situation. So this thing kind of illustrates one end member in terms of the physics that you get in EM induction, where the coupling is completely through the magnetic field. There's no forcing of currents from source to region of interest. So it's purely this inductive effect. The other end member is galvanic effect. I'm going to mention that in a moment. In general, both of those effects are happening at the same time. And in a hand-wavy kind of sense, those are the two kinds of physics that are going on. So when it comes to do our numerical modeling, we want to try and make sure that both of those remain within our numerical solution. Certainly, if both terms are significant in what's actually going on, even if one is bigger than the other, we still need to make sure that in our numerical solution, both terms still remain in there. And that's actually been a bit of a problem with numerical solutions, is that, you know, unintentionally, of course, but people have ended up with a situation at the end where, oops, they've lost the physics from one of those effects. Arguably, that's one of the issues with the sort of classic way of doing the integral equation approach, and why the integral equation approach only really worked for contrasts less than, say, I think about 300 to 1. It was the issue of losing the inductive component, I think, in the numerics, and only being left with a galvanic component, which ends up being not the physics that's involved if you're in this extreme situation where you've got your conductive lump isolated in a purely resistive background. Anyways, I think that's correct. The whole point is just to illustrate induction, which is one end member in terms of the physical behaviors going on in EM geophysical methods. The other consequence of Ohm's law, in the fact that we're dealing with the ground, the Earth, which is a non-zero conductivity, so that electric charges can flow through it. This means that we end up being in the quasi-static regime, but this has a large impact, a very crucial impact on the physics of what's actually going on with our electromagnetic fields, and makes we in geophysics kind of our own little subset in contrast to everybody else that's dealing with electromagnetic fields, such as electrical engineers and such, who are dealing with electromagnetic fields predominantly up in the air in a vacuum. So I just want to talk a little bit about the quasi-static situation. The next few slides, I essentially want to follow the way John Weaver does it in his book, Geo-Electromagnetic Induction. I like how he does it. There's a number of different ways of sort of assessing this quasi-static situation. There are variations on the same sort of theme, but I like the way John Weaver did it. So I'm just going to sort of start off with the equations, kind of did a bit of what we did yesterday, the usual, where we start off with Faraday's law and Ampere's law, okay, with B in here instead of H, but the corresponding mu naughts appearing over here. Go with the time derivatives at the moment, so thinking in the time domain, and just do the necessary manipulations to get our electric field partial differential equation. So take the curl of Faraday's law, that will give us our curl E, that gives us our d by dt of curl B, but then we use Faraday's law to replace the curl B by this stuff. So that gives us our second order partial differential equation. This is full on in 3D for our electric field with a term involving the two curls, repeated curls. There's a d by dt term that has a sigma coefficient in front of it. That comes all the way back from the current density term in Ampere's law. And then there's the second order time derivative of the electric field that has the epsilon naught out front. That comes all the way back from the displacement current term in Ampere's law. So we're definitely keeping these two terms in here at the moment. Ultimately, the argument is going to be that this is going to be negligible compared to this term, but the whole point of the next few slides is to demonstrate that, yes, in our situation, EMG physics in the ground, this term is negligible compared to that. And so we're going to do that by looking at the size of the various terms in this partial differential equation. And the way that John Weaver does it is do a bit of dimensionality analysis, so introduce variables that are dimensionless. So in particular, introduce a new time variable t prime that's just a scaled time variable where you scale it by periods, typical periods of the time variations that you're looking at. And so this is kind of equivalent to if you were studying an electromagnetic field of a certain sort of period, very, very sort of hand-wavy here, and you were drawing that variation as a function of time, then this big T ends up being the units that you'd end up probably using on your horizontal axis so you could draw that time variation on a reasonable kind of a graph. So that's really all that this scaling is doing. So we're doing it with time. For example, a couple of numbers here. If this, the periods that you were looking at were 100 to 200 seconds, periods of interest, then you'd take big T to be, say, 100 seconds. So you'd end up being that for periods from 100 to 200 seconds, that would correspond to values of T prime between, say, 1 and 2. And kind of the idea here is to get the three terms in our differential equation for the electric field in a form that they can be compared to 1 in size. So the idea here would be to try and get from T that goes from 1 to 200 down to a T prime that correspondingly goes from like 1 to 2. Similarly, if we're looking at like 1 kilohertz frequency, say a controlled source prospecting system, so periods 10 to the minus 3, then take big T to be this, for example, 0.001 seconds, then T prime is going to be correspondingly equal to sort of 1. You know, if the T's that we are typically looking at for 1 kilohertz correspond to this, and we normalize by that, then our T primes are going to be like 1. Hopefully this is somewhat clear. Likewise, for the spatial derivative, the spatial variable, we're going to scale our spatial variable by a typical sort of length scale that we're looking at. You know, if we've got a survey length of a few hundred kilometers and the features of interest are about 10 kilometers in size, observation locations about 10 kilometers apart, then 10 kilometers might be a sensible number here, so that, sure, your survey length is about, 100 kilometers, but normalizing by L, so you'd be drawing that survey line on a scale that is 10 long, so like 10 centimeters long on a piece of paper. What numbers did I actually say here? Probably something similar. So this idea is just to try and get a transfer of variables, change of variables, into a new set of variables that kind of have sensible values, so round about the value of 1 kind of thing, not 10,000 and not 10 to the minus 3, but round about the value of 1, of order 1. So once we've done that, we can then look to see how that impacts the derivatives. And in terms of changing from d by dt to d by dt prime, then we get our 1 over big T in here. And then changing our d by dx into a d by dx prime, then that gives us our 1 over big L in here. And if we go back and look at that electric field differential equation, so this is our differential equation with spatial derivatives term, first order derivative respect to time with the connectivity in front of it, second order derivative respect to time with the permittivity effects in here, and just change those derivatives now into t primes and the d by dx primes, then what we end up with is effectively two coefficients in here, where this first coefficient involves our mu naught sigma, but gets multiplied by an L squared that came from a 1 over L squared on this side from these two spatial derivatives, and a 1 over big T that comes from the change of d by dt into d by dt prime. And then this coefficient here in front of the second order time derivative, that turns from mu naught epsilon naught into mu naught epsilon naught, big L squared again, that comes from the 1 over L squared from the left-hand side, and then a 1 over T squared that comes from the second order derivative respect to time. So we've now got these two coefficients that kind of depend on the typical periods we're looking at, typical frequencies, typical length scales, and the connectivity of the materials we're looking at, the connectivities of the ground. And so we can actually just throw in some numbers and kind of see, well, typically for EMG physics, what is the size of this thing? What is the size of that number? And hence, what's the relative importance? Also, we're going to be able to say, because having done this change of variables, this term here is kind of going to be of order one. So depending on the size of these two things, we can compare the size of both of these derivatives with respect to one, the strength, the importance of our curl-curl term. So just sticking in the numbers. So here's those two coefficients, the one subscript sigma that's relative to the conductivity term, the one subscript epsilon relative to the permittivity term. And so, for example, if we got to a typical length scale of 10 kilometers, typical period of 10 seconds, and some conductivity that's not particularly conductive, not particularly resistive, and stick those numbers in here, let's see, mu naught is 4 pi times 10 to the minus 7, which is kind of a 10 to the minus 6. Okay, our sigma is 10 to the minus 2. L squared is 10,000 squared. We've got our 10 on the bottom for the period. You know, so that value turns out to be 0.1. Sticking in the numbers for the coefficient for the permittivity term, the epsilon term, mu naught to epsilon naught is 1 over c squared. So the speed of light squared, that's where that comes in. It's a huge number. So once we stick things in, this eta subscript epsilon is tiny, amazingly tiny compared to coefficient in front of the conductivity, the coefficient with the conductivity term and relative to the spatial derivative term. So for this setup, for sure, the term that has this as a coefficient is completely and utterly negligible, no questions about it, compared to the conductivity term. If you look at, say, a more mineral exploration scenario, looking at 100 meters down into the ground, say, 10 kilohertz frequency, again, same conductivity, not too high, not too low, stick the numbers in. Again, the eta subscript epsilon is dominated by this huge c squared on the bottom. So even although we've decreased the period quite a bit, so we've decreased things on the bottom quite a bit, still, this number is small relative to the other numbers in that differential equation. So basically, it boils down to the fact that for all EM geophysics, arguably even GPR, because this is exactly what GPR is up against, struggles against, but for all EM geophysics, the ratio of the, so this first order time derivative of our electric field that has a connectivity out front, the ratio of the importance of that term to the second order time derivative of the electric field, that wavy term, is going to be huge. So in other words, this term is going to be always negligible compared to the connectivity term. And the only way that that last term, the second order time derivative term, can start to have any relevance, any importance whatsoever, is if, let's see, the period has to be amazingly small and the connectivity has to be amazingly small. I mean, if you're up in the air where sigma is zero, then, of course, that term vanishes, and yeah, you've got the d2e by dt squared. But if you've got any kind of connectivity, no matter how small, then this term is going to be non-zero, and yeah, the wavy term in that differential equation for electric field is going to be negligible. So this is exactly what is known as the quasi-static regime. You know, it's not static, because things are most definitely varying with time. Again, go back to Faraday's law. If things were completely static and not changing, we would not have any EM induction whatsoever. So it's not the static regime, but it's almost static. It's quasi-static. In terms of sort of what this means sort of conceptually, it's kind of like that the time variations that we are interested in of the particular fields that we're interested in are stupendously slow compared to the time it would take light to travel across the area we're looking at, or sort of equivalently, the wavelengths, if we were to try and attribute a wavelength to the electromagnetic fields we're studying, their wavelengths would be huge relative to the future that we are actually looking at. So two different sort of physical ways of thinking about this quasi-static situation. And so, I mean, this is hugely important. That this is what separates EM geophysics from engineering electromagnetic stuff. And these were the two pictures I showed you yesterday. And the physics of what's going on with EM induction in the ground, it's much more like a vector diffusion equation. It is not at all a wave equation. And so that's why the electric field, so this is downwards in depth. There's no propagation of a wave down here. There's precious little waviness to be seen in the ground. You know, okay, there's a change of sign that you can see on log scale, but really the thing that's happening is just this dampening of the field down into, down into the ground, very much like a sort of diffusion, an exponential decay, an exponential diffusion down into the ground. And that's all because of this whole quasi-static situation, the effect of the electrical conductivity of the ground. Another way to think about it is because we have this non-zero electrical conductivity, and we have our electric wave coming down from the air, impinging on the ground, getting into the ground, it's got an alternating electric field with it for a wave. But once we get into our conductor, then because we're in a conductor, by definition, we've got charges that can move around in response to this moving electric field. So those charges just happily go sloshing backwards and forwards, whee, as this electric field comes in here. And so you're just going to lose energy from your wave. And so that's another way to think about it. This electrical conductivity just greatly dampens this wave and dampens it to such an extent that it's not really a wave anymore in the ground. So that's critical, important. From the context of numerical modeling, it does now mean that we're not having to model waves coming in, propagating through our region. So that means, actually going to the second point here, we don't have to worry about any waves bouncing around off our boundaries or rattling around inside our domain. So that's a nice thing. We don't now have to worry about the size of our cells relative to a wavelength to try and do any accurate numerical modeling, which is what people have to worry about if they're modeling numerical modeling of seismic waves. It's critical to get enough cells per wavelength to adequately model what's going on. We don't have to worry about that. The thing we do have to worry about is this decay, this exponential decay of the fields going into a conductor, and we just have to make sure that our cell sizes are small enough relative to the skin depth, the depth over which our field is going to decay to 1 over e of its starting value. We just have to make sure that our cell sizes are small enough relative to that decay length, skin depth, to adequately model what's going on. So in the context of numerical modeling, these are the things that we have to be aware of now that we appreciate we're dealing with sort of decaying, diffusive kind of behavior, not wave behavior. Oh, one final comment. What am I saying here? Oh, yeah. And so the particularly nice thing about the way John Weaver does it with that change of variables, for sure it compares the relative strength of these two terms. So this is first order time derivative with the connectivity term. And so now this term for sure dominates this in any kind of EM geophysics. But now we kind of know the size of this relative to the size of our spatial derivative term. Because once we did our change of variables, the whole point was to try and get this thing to be sort of size 1, and then we were comparing both of these terms, not just to each other, but to something of size 1. And if you can remember the numbers, those two examples I gave you, the second example, this term was kind of size 1, so comparable, but the first example, this term was coming out to be of the size 0.1, of order of 0.1, which is still significant, still not negligible, compared to that term, but it's starting to be small, one order of magnitude less than this spatial derivative term. And that was for a sort of typical scenario. If you now start to look at scenarios where the connectivity might be more resistive and you're starting to consider longer periods than I considered in that example, then this term does actually start to get quite small relative to this term. So right there, so this is negligible in terms of the physics that's going on. This is important in terms of the physics that's going on. So we can't lose this as telling us something important. However, if the effect of this is now getting small relative to that, then there is the chance that when we go to our numerical approximation, and never mind rounding error, but at a stage earlier than that, there is the chance that in the numerics, this term starts to become small enough that its importance kind of drops out of the numerical system. And I should mention that a little bit later, but for example, that's the reason in some of the numerical modeling methods for MT, certainly the finite difference methods that have been used, that Torkel Smith came up with the static divergence correction term, because in this equation for MT, he was finding that the importance of this term basically dropped away for smallish connectivity and for smallish frequencies, smallish frequencies, longish periods. I think I got that the wrong way around earlier. And so this term is dominating the numerics, and this term is vanishing. And so he introduced an extra correction term that counteracted that effect. There are situations where losing this starts to happen from the numerics, and that causes problems. That's sort of an example of starting to lose physics that's, okay, not hugely important, but is still critical in actually losing that from the numerics, and that causes all sorts of problems. Enough on the quasi-static situation. Continuing with the various laws and such, there's still lots of them. The other sort of important fundamental one is conservation of charge. So the divergence of the current density, assuming we're in a source-free region, so we're not in somewhere where there's a source that's introducing charge or magically removing charge. Divergence of the current density is going to be zero. This is quasi-static situation. Just as an example of how all these rules and regulations for electromagnetics are not providing, each one is not providing one independent piece of information, but it's all sort of a redundant pile of information. If we take Ampere's law, curl H is equal to J, quasi-static domain, everything from now on is going to be quasi-static regime, and just take the divergence of this, then divergence of a curl, zero no matter what. So that tells us divergence of J is going to be zero directly from Ampere's law. So that's just an example of how a lot of these things are interrelated. In terms of conservation of charge, if we start to think about what that means within our Earth, where our connectivity is non-zero, then okay, J is sigma E, so we've got the divergence of our current density, this product of connectivity and electric field has to be zero, so that's something our numerical solution should satisfy, one would hope. Just as an example here of the physics of what's going on, earlier I had that picture for EM induction where the link between the source and the induced currents was through the magnetic field through what could be free space. There doesn't have to be no connectivity, doesn't need to be any flow of charge. That was one end member. This equation kind of demonstrates the other end member. This is the equation that governs, governs is not the right word, but describes, quantifies, encapsulates what goes on in a DC resistivity situation where we've got, say, two electrodes pumping current into the ground, in principle a steady current, and then we just go and measure the potential difference anywhere else. This is this equation, which is valid at zero frequency. This equation describes that. So it's very much to do with the flow of current, just kind of like in this DC resistivity experiment, pumping current in one situation, sucking it out somewhere else. If we have a conductive lump in the ground, the connectivity is better, so it's easier for current to flow through that. So in this situation, current will get sucked into that conductor just because it preferentially likes to flow through that. These are sort of typically described as galvanic effects. Fairly recent picture. This is not a DC resistivity experiment, but kind of illustrates this whole galvanic effect. Little arrows are for electric field. Color scale shows the strength of the electric field. And the arrows show the direction. There's a block here that's a bit more conductive. There's a block here that's a bit less conductive. Yes. And this kind of shows the classic sort of galvanic effect, this current channeling effect. You can sort of see the arrows pointed in here and being pushed and squirted out here. So current is, what do you say? Current is preferentially flowing through this better conductor. Is that what I said? Better conductor, poorer conductor. So the current is getting channeled ever so slightly through this block, but because this is the poorer conductor here, it's getting squirted out the side and flows through this homogeneous half space. There's definitely a connectivity to this half space for sure. It's between the connectivities of those two things. So this kind of a picture just illustrates galvanic effect, very much current flowing through everywhere, getting concentrated through good conductors and trying to avoid somewhat the poorer conductors, and all to do with this flow of current through the material. So in contrast to the induction end member where the linkage was through the magnetic field. There was no current flowing from source to our conductive lump. It was all, the connection was all through the magnetic field. Now it's very much through the flow of charge, the actual flow of current from whatever our source is through our conductive lumps. So that tries to illustrate this galvanic situation, this other end member of this range of EM induction effects. And typically, in most situations, there's both of those things going on, the linkage through the magnetic field through induction, and then this business of current flowing through material preferentially through conductors and preferentially away from poorer conductors. So that's conservation of charge. Couple of other things with it. And so again, this is these are redundant pieces of information, but now explicitly thinking about what the general conservation of charge might mean if we were to just look at, say, for example, an interface, because ultimately we're going to have a model that's discretized into cells of uniform connectivity. I think absolutely everybody does that to discretize the rare earth model. So we're going to have to think about what happens to our approximate electric field from one cell to the neighboring cell, especially if the connectivity is different from one cell to the next. Then if we take the conservation of charge and kind of figure out what it tells us about what's happening at that interface, then of course that tells us that the normal component of current density has to be continuous, because the amount of charge coming into that interface has to equal the amount of charge going away from it. We don't get any weird and wonderful situation where there's an infinite current squirting up through the face of our cells. We have to have same current coming in as there is going out. So that tells us, you know, normal component of current density is continuous. But we know how the current density is related to the product of connectivity and electric field through Ohm's law. So if we in our model know what the connectivity in this cell is, and we know what the connectivity in that cell is, then because J is continuous across there, the normal J is continuous, then that tells us the amount by which our normal electric field is discontinuous across if we have a change in connectivity from one cell to another. That's kind of what's said in here. Well, not quite. So that's another sort of, you know, piece of information comes from conservation of charge, but specifically thinking about what's happening at an interface. also from this, if we are now thinking of a uniform region, part of our model in which connectivity is not changing, so for example, within a cell, within a typical cell, then connectivity is uniform within that cell. So we can pull it all the way out here, or we can do this thing. So it ends up basically that just the divergence of the electric field is going to be zero within a region of uniform connectivity. So again, small, subtle piece of information, but you know, that's a rule, that's a regulation that the true electric field is going to obey. So we're going to, if possible, come up with an approximate electric field that, you know, satisfies that condition within each cell in our model, or maybe not. Again, if you look at Ampere's law and Faraday's law and do the same sort of thing to figure out what they tell us about what's happening at an interface, then we also get your tangential electric field is continuous, tangential H field is continuous across interfaces, whether there's a change of connectivity or not. So again, just, you know, redundant information, but information in the form that's explicitly appropriate to an interface between cells in our model. Again, at these sort of smaller level pieces of information, if we again look at a homogeneous region and look at what our equation would be in that homogeneous region, so same old equation, now in the frequency domain, and just the connectivity term, because for sure, quasi-static regime, so no epsilon term in here whatsoever. Curl-curl term, sigma term. Vector identity, this curl-curl term is equal to grad div minus del squared, as long as we're in Cartesian coordinates. So if we're now sitting in a homogeneous region, a uniform region, say for example within a cell, this divergence electric field is zero. That pops out, so we're just left with this nicer looking equation. It's the Laplacian in there. Typical way to deal with this. So the net from now on, it's not 1D assumption or anything like that. It's still just assuming we're in a uniform region, 3D space. But if we do our 2D Fourier transform on this to get our, say, dx and dy derivatives transformed into a kx squared and ky squared business, just to leave us with a d by dz, doesn't matter which two of the spatial derivatives you apply this to. But this would then give you an ordinary differential equation for the electric field as a function of z, but depends on the wave numbers in the x and y directions. And so if we're in our homogeneous region, you know, this is homogeneous, then the solution for this kind of equation is just exponentials, so e to the plus or minus, and then all involving z, so e to the plus or minus something times z, but that something is the square root of all this. So I don't really want to emphasize this too much, except to say that if we're in a homogeneous region, this is the form that the electric field takes, for sure. Okay, it's a bit of a summation, it's a Fourier series, so this could be, this could represent quite a lot of things. But in reality, this is does not represent a constant electric field or a linearly varying electric field. This represents something a bit more complex, because ultimately, invariably, in our numerical solution, we're probably going to end up with our approximate electric field having just a linear variation or just a constant variation with position in a cell, and that doesn't really fit in with this, so that would be violating this particular piece of information, particular rule, particular regulation for EM. So just an example, actually this is going to be pretty much the last thing. So for example, the finite element method for 3D, sort of the typical normal way these days to discretize the electric field is to use edge elements, these things called edge elements. So if we look at so four cells in our model, just extract out four particular cells, neighboring cells, that are neighbors along that edge, this middle edge, and so this is just repeating the picture twice, then in terms of the approximate electric field, it's represented as a series of basis functions, a lot more on this in two classes time, but essentially the basis functions are such that one of them would look like this, where if this is the x direction, and if we were looking at the x component of the electric field, then it's going to be it's going to be independent of the x direction, so it's going to be constant in the x direction. So this shaded plane here represents this plane here, and these arrows represent our approximate electric field. So there's no variation in the x direction of the electric field, and it's going to vary linearly away from this edge. So it varies linearly from a maximum here out to zero at this edge, varies from maximum here out to zero on this edge, so kind of shown by the decreasing size of the arrows as we get from the center out to the edge of this quartet of cells. And it's the same variation in that xy plane and in that xz plane. So this would be one of the basis functions that's used in the edge element method to specify our approximate electric field. So essentially that's what our approximate electric field is going to look like within this quartet of cells. And so, you know, is that good, is that bad? In terms of the good things about this particular setup, so by construction, because this electric field is based essentially on the edge at the center of these four cells, then it turns out that this approximate electric field has its tangential component that is continuous from one cell to the next by construction. So tangential E field is continuous, no matter what. So that's good. That was one of the rules and regulations that we had to satisfy. Given this variation, there's no variation in the x direction, so d by dx of this particular field, which is pointing in the x direction, is going to be zero. D by d, and so the divergence of electric field is d by dx of x component plus d by dy of y component plus d by dz of z component. Hey, so this is the electric field in the x direction, only has an x component, but its derivative in the x direction is zero, so hey, this is going to be divergence free within each of these four cells. Hey, so that's rule number, you know, one of those other rules satisfied. So this approximate electric field is actually looking quite good. In terms of the curl of the electric field, which is going to give us our magnetic field through Faraday's law, because this field is varying in the directions perpendicular to which it's pointing, then that means the curl of this field is not going to be zero. It's probably going to have some non-zero value. Okay, so that's good. So that would correspond to a non-zero H field within these cells, which we would expect to happen. So that's good. And the other important thing about these edge elements is that there's no link between what's happening in this quartet of cells and what's happening in the quartet of cells to the next of this, to the next of this quartet. So these set of basis functions can quite easily support a jump in the electric field from this quartet to the next quartet of cells. So in other words, they can quite happily have a discontinuity in the normal component of the electric field. And so that's another thing we want to be able to do. It's a bit more subtle, but it's another thing we want to be able to do based on our rules and regulations if the connectivity is different from one cell to the next. So, you know, edge elements for the electric field are looking pretty good. They satisfy a lot of those rules and regulations just kind of by construction. And, you know, by design, that's exactly what people were thinking about. In terms of the problems with these, the edge field is not zero. But because the electric field just varies linearly in these directions, then the edge field that we get by doing the curl ends up just being constant in a cell. So our numerical solution is going to have a constant edge field within each cell. So that doesn't seem quite right. So that's already kind of violating the behavior that we kind of expect in a uniform region. This is going back to the behavior in a uniform cell, a uniform region. I mean, this electric field is constant in the x direction, varies linearly in the y and the z directions. And that variation isn't really one that we would expect given the solution of that partial differential equation in a uniform region that's a linear combination of complex exponentials. So sure, it's got a lot of good things, these edge element basis functions, but right from the start, we're already having to sort of shed some of the rules and regulations. There's already some that we're clearly not satisfying. So any approximate electric field built up using these basis functions is already starting to violate some of the rules and regulations. One slide on this, I think. I need to do more work on potentials. I think it's got a lot to it, but I don't really understand them fully. The typical, most general way of using potentials in electromagnetics is to introduce a vector potential, A, a scalar potential, phi, such that E's, you know, give or take minus signs, E is equal to the gradient of the scalar potential and the time derivative of the vector potential, and that it's the curl of the vector potential that gives you the magnetic field. So this decomposition of our E in electromagnetic fields into these two potentials plus some extra condition, because we've now got four variables floating around. And this is a unique decomposition for our potentials A and phi. If we were to look at what happens for the completely steady state situation, this term then becomes irrelevant to the electric field. And hey presto, we're in the situation that everybody uses for the DC resistivities setup, where you can represent the electric field by the gradient of a scalar potential. So that would be the zero frequency case. So there's a natural association between what this scalar potential is, even for the time-varying case. So a natural link between this scalar potential and galvanic effects, where everything is driven by just current flowing through good conductors or around bad conductors. Also, because the magnetic field is got from the curl of just the vector potential and this scalar potential doesn't appear in here at all, then there's sort of a natural link between this potential and the magnetic field. So there's a natural link between this potential and inductive effects, where the link between the transmitter and what's happening in your conductive object is purely through the magnetic field, the magnetic linkage. So a natural linkage between this and induction. So this does seem to be, and people have looked at this and have worked on this with varying degrees of success, but this seems like a good way to try and keep in your numerical solution both the inductive effects and the galvanic effects and just maintain those through the numerical approximation to an adequate level, you know, assuming that the EM induction you're getting involves both terms. I need to do more work on that, basically. In terms of today's take-home points, so no exercise for today, because I assume that all this was just revision. You folks know your EM rules and regulations inside out, backwards and forwards, etc. So just take-home points. There's a whole pile of rules and regulations, and we would like our approximate electric field to satisfy everyone, all of those rules and regulations, but there's no way that they can. So we just have to take care and be sure that the stuff that we're violating, the rules that we're violating, are not the important ones that govern what's exactly going on in our geophysical EM situation. So that's what I'm saying here. So that'll be it for today. I guess I should have mentioned at the start, for sure, same place, same time on Thursday. I think that is agreed. And probably Friday, but we'll tell you on Thursday what's happening on Friday. But so same place, same time on Thursday. Cool. Okay, so any questions? Ooh, time's running out. Time's running out. I'm not sure if there's time for questions. Any questions or comments? How new was some of this stuff? So, okay, you probably all do know EM pretty well, but a lot of this was kind of, it was very much from the perspective of what sort of becomes relevant and what becomes important when you're trying to devise a numerical implementation just to make sure you don't lose bits. So was there anything in here that you kind of went, huh, at, or took you a bit of time to figure out what I was trying to say, or you still don't understand what I was trying to say? Not a peep. And Sean's jumping up and down at the back with his hand in the air wanting to ask a question, but I'm not taking any questions from him, that's for sure. Okay, that's it for today, folks. I've had enough. I was talking for more than I kind of wanted to.